Being recorded. No off-color jokes.
Yeah, there you go.
Not gonna trap me into that one. I don't have this control lady.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was good. Just to feel that was easy before they were at the game today.
Yeah.
All right, it is 6 p.m. on Monday, September 24th, 2018. I'd like to call the Village of Alloway Plan Commission meeting to order. We'll start with roll call. Wheeler?
Here.
Dart?
Here.
Norris here. Rupp?
Here.
Kornowski?
Here.
Kowalczyk Adrian?
Here.
Nyberg?
Here.
Okay. Item number two, modify or adopt the agenda. We don't have any changes.
Move to approve.
A second.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Item number three, minutes from July 23rd, 2018. Are there any changes? If not, I will entertain a motion to approve.
So move.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Item number four, minutes from August 20th, 2018.
I'll move to approve.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Item number five, announcements.
I just have one. We have the, for those interested, we have a little unveiling, sign unveiling ceremony scheduled for Wednesday evening at 6 p.m. the intersection of Ducharme and Miramar, and that is to officially recognize the historic district, the Miramar Historic District. So, as you recall, that's been about a three-year project. In this past spring, we found out that they were listed on the National Register of Historic Places, so we had those brown signs that you see, brown street signs that we're replacing them with. So, 6 p.m., be about 15, 10 minutes. So.
Okay. Item number six, presentation regarding green infrastructure by Julia Nordic, University of Wisconsin Sea Grant.
Thank you very much for having me tonight. My name is Julia Nordic, and I work for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. It's a lot of slogans. I think Trevor invited me here, so thank you very much, Trevor. And then Angela, also I work closely with her on several projects, and in particular this one for other municipalities. So I'll tell you a little bit about Sea Grant. Sea Grant is a NOAA, the Weather People, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA University Partnership. We're a national network. So there's 33 programs, including Guam, Puerto Rico, and we're in coastal states, and we're really a partnership between NOAA and the university system to provide funding for research, outreach, technical assistance, and training and education for important coastal issues. So the Great Lakes are part of our nation's coastline, and I am an outreach specialist based up here in Green Bay. Our main office is out of Madison. And so we fund a lot of research, but but I'm an outreach specialist on water quality and coastal and I work a lot with coastal communities. And if people are familiar maybe with like the county extension model or UW extension, I'm kind of like that for the Great Lakes. So we've been called county agent hip boots. We focus a lot on important coastal issues to Wisconsin. So we have outreach specialists all along the coast. We have a fisheries outreach specialist. I'm a water quality. We have a social scientist, coastal engineering for coastal hazards. So that's a little bit about me and why Sea Grant exists in Wisconsin. And so what I'm going to talk to you tonight is a little bit about stormwater management in general, and then also some of the new kind of ways communities are starting to handle stormwater management with green infrastructure, and then some of the things maybe the Village of Alloway might be interested in doing to advance green infrastructure. So when it rains or the snow melts from our houses, normally it comes down off our roofs, goes through a gutter system, and is directly conveyed into a sewer system. So that has been traditionally how stormwater has been built. We want to get the water away from our properties, whether it's like a shopping mall or our houses, as quick as possible. But it ends up in the storm sewer where it's all condensed. And then it eventually ends up just in our local waterways. So whether it be a creek, the Fox River or the East River, eventually will end up there normally untreated. And so some of the main problems with this is along the way, along our roadways and along our parking lots, it picks up a lot of nasty kind of stuff. So let's see if this one. I don't know. This seems to work. Sorry about that. I'll just show you. Just had this set up just in case it didn't work. So you can see this picture here. So this is kind of all the, after a storm, what you'll see coming out of the storm sewer. This is all the pollution you can see, but there's a lot of things in that water that you can't see too. So we have, you know, a lot of nutrients. We have fertilizers, herbicides running off our waterways. We have brake pad dust, which contains copper and is really toxic to aquatic fish. We have oils. Our cars are continuously leaking drips of oils everywhere. So every time it rains, that first flush is really driving down a lot of pollutants. We have bacteria from animals around at dumpsters. If you think of fast food dumpsters, you know, animals potentially eating and then doing their thing and then it eventually getting washed down into our waterways. So there is what there's called is, so that's traditional gray infrastructure. And we have green infrastructure now, and green infrastructure really is a new way of thinking about how to manage stormwater. It's kind of turning it from a waste and trying to get it away from your property into a resource and trying to get it back into the ground when it either rains or the snow melts. And that's through strategic practices that I'm going to show you about that really revolve around storing it and allowing it to infiltrate or evaporate, infiltrate back into the ground and evaporate. So this is an eco-business park. This was a complete brownfield just about 10 years ago outside Milwaukee in near the Brewers Stadium, Miller Park, in the Menominee Valley. And what they did is they turned it into a giant eco-business park, and all the businesses that you see off to the right there, all of their stormwater is funneled down into this slow-moving wetlands. And so these are large stormwater-type ponds, wetlands, settling wetlands, and so they're meant to slow that stormwater down, and then that gives a chance to filter out some of the pollutants, and the plants really suck up those pollutants. And then eventually it goes down into the Milwaukee River. So these are green infrastructures all about restoring hydrological processes to get that water back in the ground. So these are what are called bioswales. And so I like this picture because the top part of that where the plants are, you can see what it would be like completely grown out. But the bottom part is like how you can see how it is specifically engineered to meander and really slow down that stormwater so it's not you know, causing problems downstream, and it gives it a chance to really soak into the ground. Permeable pavements, people are familiar with these. This is basically, right now, all of our pavement is really the water just kind of flows off, and it can't get, the water can't get through it. But permeable, there's a lot of permeable materials out there, and you can see in the bottom one, this is the top one is traditional asphalt, but the bottom one is porous asphalt, and so that water is just soaking straight into the ground. There's a lot of different technologies. This is at the Brown County Ashwaubenon Library, right down the road, and these are called drain pavers, and they just took a little area of their parking lot and funneled that water, and so all the water that's drained would normally be drained to the sewer actually just gets drained right into the ground rather than being put in the sewer system. Here's just another example. I wanted to give just another example of this is a green alleyway. So pavers can be really strategically placed in certain areas, so it doesn't take up the whole road, and this can really mitigate a lot of that runoff. People might be familiar with the term rain gardens. They're also can be known as bioretention systems. They're engineered systems. They are what they sound like. They're like depressions in the ground that collect the rainwater and allow it to evaporate or infiltrate right back into the ground. So this is a good example of one that's collecting water off the roadway in this residential neighborhood. Rain harvesting systems. Most people, I would think, are really familiar with rain barrels, probably one of the most popular forms of green infrastructure. But I wanted to show you this one. This is at the Menominee Valley. It's collecting stormwater off of 36 Highway, the Highway 36 that crosses there, and it collects 68,000 gallons of stormwater a year from the roadways. Otherwise, that would have de-icing salts in them, anything coming off those cars above. Planter boxes are good for some downtown urban areas, and they kind of just go on the side of the house. Instead of your downspout going directly to the sewer drain or storm sewer, you can put it into a box, and it actually, the plants there absorb the pollutants, and then you can use it as an aesthetic and stormwater management too. Just mention the use of deep-rooted plants. These can be natives or these can be tall grasses. But turf grass, currently, that is one of the most popular forms of landscaping, you know, requires a lot of maintenance. It requires herbicides and fertilizers, and those things can be costly and then also impact our waterways. So deep-rooted plants, turf grass has short roots, but native plants have really long roots, and that water just infiltrates to the bottom. So if you have native or deep-rooted plants in, like, your rain garden, you're not going to have standing water. It's actually going to drain out of there within hours of a system. Green roofs. So green roofs are not only that a good stormwater management practice, they can collect 40 to 60% of the stormwater, but they provide a really, they can also help reduce energy costs on buildings and increase the lifespan of the roof 2 to 3 times. This one is at St. Mary's Hospital in Green Bay. They use it for aesthetic purposes for their patients and for their staff too. And I believe that they put this in as a trade for their stormwater permit related to parking area. Stormwater trees. So you see in a lot of areas trees downtown. But if you have an arborist, you know, a lot of these trees aren't given the appropriate amount of root space. So we can, and trees soak up a lot of water. So you can design tree trenches and tree boxes like this one. It actually goes, these cells actually go in underneath the street, and you can allow the roots to spread. And so it makes your trees downtown actually grow a lot longer and live a lot longer, too. And then last is opportunities to restore or preserve floodplain. This is a large stormwater flood basin, wetland basin that's outside of Ann Arbor, but it's not only just there to provide pollution reduction and stormwater management, but they've completely turned it into a community asset, and there's walking trails all around this area, too. Okay, so why are codes and ordinances so important to green infrastructure in general for communities? Well, as you are very aware, codes and ordinances help really dictate a lot of the community services and how the community works, whether it's standards for public roads, and sidewalks and driveway widths, whether it's maintenance of public and private property. It also, you know, codes and ordinances set forth the governance of how things are decided within a community, too. So green infrastructure, not having green infrastructure in your code ordinance language can be a really big barrier. And then there's a lot of times our communities were really built around a time before we knew the impacts of stormwater on our local waterways and flooding, for example. And so our codes and ordinances are extremely outdated around the country right now. For example, there's examples of, you know, down in a community outside of Milwaukee, where to tie your horse up downtown properly, or different parking ratios for men's and women's department stores. So we have very outdated regulations, and with all that new technology, with green infrastructure, it's just not meant to really, you know, to help people, you know, a developer or the planning commission decide whether something should be put in or not. And so and even the absence of the word green infrastructure or these practices can be a barrier. Some communities, I'll just talk briefly a little bit about some other things for codes and ordinances, is if you have, you know, someone in a community, why they're important is if you have a charismatic leader, whether it, you know, the public works director, maybe it's the village president, who really wants to get things done, but what happens if they don't get reelected? Maybe they get hit by the beer truck and decide to take their family to Mexico for the rest of their lives. We don't know. So what the best thing we can do is really get green infrastructure codified, and so that it can continue, or their legacy can continue in the future, and all the work that's been made doesn't just get left behind. Another issue a lot of communities deal with, or we've heard, is, you know, when no one's deciding. Oh, we let the developer decide what to do. So what is missing in this picture? So you have, this is an example of a bioretention system. You put in your new parking lot. There doesn't seem to be any curbs there preventing any of those people from going straight into your very expensive bioretention system that you just put in. And so having bad design standards, or just a lack of them in general, showing people how to do things, can really be a deterrent and can lead to failed practices that we don't want in general. So I really like to point out, this is really not about more regulation or cost in general. We know that hedging can be something, aesthetics, a lot of communities use for landscape for hedging and for screening. But we know water does not run uphill. So what we really want to do is start thinking a little smarter about what we're requiring developers to do, and how we can actually combine practices, so that maybe some of our landscape features can actually be stormwater management practices too. So you might be thinking, okay, so what? We fully comply with our stormwater permit here, but, you know, this sad, sad tree was permitted in full compliance of Wisconsin state stormwater practices. It's not a happy tree at this point. It's not going to survive. And people put resources into this tree. So it's really about thinking about those resources and doing things a little bit differently. So why are codes so important for green infrastructure? Well, we know if the code language does not talk about green infrastructure, or encourage it or promote it, that it's very unlikely that it will get submitted in site review plans or design plans and development proposals in general. And so we really want to know, to help people like yourselves, does this actually really matter? So code language, although I am talking to the Planning Commission, can seem a little, you know, ambiguous, or like, why would a code really make a difference in terms of water quality or quantity? So what we aim to do is kind of help demonstrate that. And so we have a code revision here that's that would be a code amendment to allow the use of permeable materials in alleys and driveways in general. So not that great to look at. People go, okay, sure, whatever. But what we did is we took the Wisconsin Windslam stormwater modeling, and we took a parcel. So this is a 56-square-foot alleyway in Milwaukee, and the drainage area is 25,000 feet. And if we redevelop that into a green alley under the code amendment, you can see that reduction in not only pollution, but also volume. And so total suspended solids is all that sediment and dirt that's going down there. So that's a significant reduction right there. Another example, as we have encouraged just the use of natives, those deep-rooted plants instead of lawns and turf grass. And for this site, this is a 1.74-acre site. So just alone, if they only replace their turf grass with just native plantings and deep-rooted plantings, this amount of volume of stormwater coming off this property is really significant. So we aim to, with these examples, to kind of demonstrate the impacts codes can have on your water quality and quantity within a community. So yes, codes and ordinances do matter. I have a bunch of workbooks here. You guys can thumb through. We have them online, too. You don't have to keep these.
And if you don't want this after you're done talking or you've seen enough, we have it online too with some postcards. Then you can feel free to hand it back to me.
Okay. So with my partners, have you heard of 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin? So 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin is a small land use nonprofit down in Madison. They help people do low-impact development and write comprehensive planning. They had a project working with the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District and all 28 municipalities, where they actually went out and audited the municipalities within the service area to see if there's barriers in the codes and ordinances for green infrastructure. And so this workbook is a product of that, is a tool. What makes this audit really unique is that it really comes at it with a community engagement approach. We know that communities are very different from each other, and so we're not going to be able to. It really depends on what your community's goals are and what you want to get out of any of this project. So what you have in your hands is a tool, and we're here to help kind of figure out, work with the community to figure out what their goals are. There's no one model code ordinance for green infrastructure. I just showed you several different types of practices. And then, as you know, the codes and ordinances are very different between municipalities. So there's not just going to be one that size fits all for a community. And what this tool is really about is kind of figuring out where there's barriers and where there could be improvements and letting the community decide what kind of code changes they'd like to make to help meet their goals. We ask questions about natural assets. Do you have things in your community that, you know, water resources that are a point of pride or that you do really want to protect within your natural resources? Are there recent hazards or are there current hazards that exist in Alway? I'm not sure, but green infrastructure can also reduce the volume, as you've seen. It really takes strain off of our gray stormwater infrastructure, too. What kind of community character and identity do you have? Do you have already some maybe environmentally friendly groups who are working in the area that would be advocates of green infrastructure in general or be interested in promoting it? And then what are your current and future development needs? So are you already built out? Do you have maybe subdivisions in your future? Is it a lot of redevelopment at this point? What are your goals and how can green infrastructure fit into those? Another thing, as you flip through this, you'll probably notice that this is a pretty in-depth tool. It's in the weeds. I would say, you know, it takes definitely a planner who likes to look at code language some effort to go through this with a community. A lot of the communities I've worked with hire planning consultants to do the work for them. We have several, I think 15 different areas the code audit looks at when they look at your codes and ordinances. Ranging from the permeable materials to the public work standards to zonings, subdivisions, parking. Landscape parking is a really big one and a big opportunity. Uh, Part of the audit is a nuanced code ranking, so we recognize that as much as we like, there is no like yes or no when we have a bunch of questions about green infrastructure and code language. And so while something might be completely in the code, say yes, you can do this, or completely prohibited even, there's a lot of nuance in between those answers. So maybe one part of the code conflicts with another. So, for example, one part of the code allows permeable surfacing, those permeable pavers, but another part of your code requires it to be complete, every surface to be seal-coated. Kind of defeats the purpose of having a permeable surface in general. So the audit really kind of tries to look at some of the ways that it's conflicting. And like I said earlier, too, if the code language doesn't offer any guidance or even mention the practice, then developers aren't going to know where that they can use it, and then what kind of design standards would be appropriate for the community. This is an example of an audit question regarding landscaping. So is the use of deep-rooted plants, native plants, edibles encouraged in landscaping standards in general, or is it just all turf grass and some of the standard trees that we're looking at? And then they kind of go through the exercise of looking at specific areas of the code and figure out where the community falls or the codes and ordinance fall in terms of whether it's a barrier or not. At the very end, you go through all these categories, and then it gives you a report card. And so while it would be nice to, most likely you'll find a lot of areas for improvement, but this is really just to get a gauge of areas that you want, and so that's when you start thinking back to, what kind of assets do we have to protect, what's really important to our goals about the community in terms of stormwater management in those areas that may or may not work well for you. And so just to wrap up a little bit again, this audit's really focused on, what Alloway wants out of their community goals and how green infrastructure really fits into that bigger picture. So I would say thank you very much, and I'm more than happy to take questions right now. I have worked with a couple of different municipalities in Wisconsin, and so if there's any questions around that, I'd be happy to answer anything. So, and thank you very much for your time.
Is there something residents can do without having the village go through a big expensive project? So along the drainage routes for the stormwater?
Yeah, definitely. I think rain barrels are definitely one of the more popular options. And then I encourage people to look at their property, and I've definitely seen some drainage issues solved just by some simple rain gardens on their property, too. I know at my house that has occurred. It wasn't more stormwater management, it was drainage. I was having like water at my front door, but I just diverted it to, I dug out a hole in my yard and put in some of these plants. And so those are some of the more simple things to do, for sure.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
One more question. With all the water going in and filtering into the biofuels from the parking lots, does that create a brownfield in your own yard with all the toxics coming off of the cars into, and you're saving them on your property instead of flushing them down the drain?
Well, I have not seen research related to that. Plants are really good. The engineer types of green infrastructure, so the bigger scale ones, soil is really, it is really good at filtering out these toxins, and then the plants can be really good at taking them up too. I don't have expertise on this, but my educated guess would be that these pollutants, as they're broken down in the soil by microbes to some extent too. In Wisconsin, we have to worry about salt too, so if you're planning these kind of practices, we want to think about like salt tolerant plants and not put a bunch of plants in there that are going to die because the snowplow came through too.
Can I just add one thing? So one of the reasons I asked Julia, or I asked all of you wanted to hear from Julia, is because since we're going through our process of the code rewrite, in working with the city of Sheboygan, I've seen a lot of examples where even though the city of Sheboygan wanted to promote green infrastructure. They had it all through the comprehensive plan. As we look through their code, we see a lot of places where, not meaning to, they would have language in there that would prevent them from having the very things that they had sustainability committees promoting and they had their comprehensive plan promoting. So I thought, since this is a great opportunity to go into our code rewrite, to take a look if we're maybe doing the same thing.
It's one of the best times to do it, too, for sure. And there's a, I can help also, too, depending on, Trevor and the village's decision, but there are funding opportunities out there that can help get these audits funded also. So, yeah. And I'll take your books back if you don't want them. Like I said, you can download them online, too. But feel free to keep it if you feel like working through your own codes.
I'll just hang on to mine.
No problem.
Thank you.
There's a
perfect.
Find our website.
I'll just keep an autograph copy.
Thank you again. I think we can move to item number 7, public appearances. If anyone is here that wants to speak on a topic that is not on a future agenda item, you can come forward and speak now. Just state your name and address up at the podium.
Jamar Mark, 2339 Oakwood Avenue. First of all, that was a great presentation, and I'd like to see that adopted here, the rainwater thing. I'd just like to make sure that the new zoning code rewrite focuses on riverfront development, getting rid of the industrial zoning, and making it friendly for developers to put in both residential and commercial properties along the Fox River Trail between Riverside Drive and the river. And whether it's shared parking, we're going to talk about parking today, but I think this is the time to really look carefully at the Riverside zoning, more so than in any other parts of the village. Thanks.
Anyone else? Okay, we can move to item 8. Action regarding the sign exception request by Jones Sign Company for 2101 South Webster Avenue for Webster Elementary Schools. Trevor, do you want
to? All right, well, the computer is loading and seems to be going slow tonight. In your packet, you have a exhibit of the proposed sign. And I guess what the Green Bay Public School is looking at for variance. In our code, we allow for a building that's over 25,000 square feet or has more than 3 tenants to have a sign larger than the standard 32 square feet per side. When they're over 25,000 square feet, we allow for 40 square feet per set. So they do meet that size requirement here. However, there are a few things that they do not. One of which is one up here. One of which is we do allow the electronic message center signs or the EMCs. They are supposed to be, according to our code, ancillary towards the total sign. So how we have it worded is the EMCs are to take up more than 40% of the sign area, or 19.2 square feet. That number came from 40% of 32 square feet. So this sign is a little larger than that 32 square feet, and the EMC sign area takes up approximately 50% of the total sign area. So slightly above what we allow. Another standard that they're seeking an exception for is we do require a sign base around the base of the sign, 2 feet high, and they would like to seek an exception from that rule and just have the pole-mounted sign, as you see here. I think that was it. Yes. So those are the two exceptions we're seeking. By ordinance, we allow for this exception process should the Planning Commission vote for improvement. There are the standards that are included on the application that the applicant filled out and is in your packet. And then also on that sheet, they have their argument for why they are seeking the exception. We do have someone here from Jones Sign for any questions.
If I'm looking at these measurements correctly, this sign doesn't look like it's really changing that much in size from what they currently have.
Thank you, Board, and just, thank you for your time. So just to elaborate what Trevor's trying to convey here is we're really just updating the cabinet. We're leaving the posts. And the factor here is that this sign is actually not being paid for by the Green Bay Public School Systems, but rather by the PTO committee. So I was really trying to design a sign that brought them into the 21st century with the EMC and all the advantages of a video messaging center, but also try to keep the cost down. And that was really the intention. It was really just to take off the original cabinet, update it with the new cabinet, without going through a whole sign design. And so thank you for hearing that. Candace was the art teacher who helped me immensely with the design. So
yeah, one of my roles is marketing and community outreach. So yes, our PTO has been so gracious to budget this for us, so otherwise we wouldn't have been able to afford it.
Then we take it the school district is fine. The school is fine with it then.
Well, in Green Bay Public Schools, we built much larger signs for them, actually. So up there, this is just.
And it was approved by the appropriate people at the district.
It was? Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it would be my understanding that we, of the pole sign in there, is grandfathered in from before we had the monument type signs, is that right?
That's correct.
And we must have something that says if you change it by X amount, then you have to replace it?
Right. It's size, shape, or type. So if they were to use the existing frame, they could keep it as is. But then also if they're to keep the reader board, they could keep it as is, but because they're going from a reader board to an EMC, that's a different type.
My problem is I don't see that it fits in with any of the exceptions that we are given to make the exception for. Any of the criteria. I personally think it's a good idea, but that's not what I'm here to say. I'm here to say these are the rules, and that doesn't fit. Even the size, the little extra of what's supposed to be the message is supposed to be 40% or less, I could see that, but not making them convert to a monument would be difficult for me. We've gone over signs over and over and over here, so it's really not that you don't want to, but you can't keep making exceptions.
I mean, there would be a significant cost difference versus what we're proposing here versus a new monument. Thousands of dollars difference.
Yeah,
and again, it was an PTO initiative and not. Not to take away from.
It's great. My kids went to that school, yes. I agree. I think the sign could be different. I'm just. If our job is to look at it based on the criteria laid out. I can't see that we can allow an exception. That's just my opinion. So let's see what everybody else has to say.
Well, the thing is, it's, it'd be easy to say, okay, you know, it's off the roadway a little bit. It's not interfering with anybody. But we do need to concern ourselves with setting precedents. You know, the next person that comes along may have something more, you know, something like you're doing, although it's bigger or, you know. So there's, I'm kind of agreeing with she said, but yet I'm still wrestling with it, so I better quit talking.
Yeah, I know. I would like to do it.
Well, I'd like to say yes, and I'm thinking about
it. I would like
about,
to say yes.
I mean, and my only other additional point would be if this were a commercial enterprise, doctor, a dentist, whomever. I'm not picking on doctors and dentists, but then I could see following the absolute letter of the code. But this is a public school, and parents and students are coming in every day. And there's a service, too, providing this message center for all those students and all those parents every day. So I would just ask you to consider that. And I do mean that sincerely. And that's not just my sales pitch, because I completely do work with the Green Bay Public Schools as well. And they're very happy with these upgrades for a legitimate reason, not just because they flash pretty colors.
If I might add, there is a garden underneath there, and that students and staff have planted, and you know this was obviously taken at a time when the garden was not there, but it does cover a lot of that. 2 feet below is all
Trevor, could you just go back up to the sign exception? Shall be granted only if that section. Can we zoom in on that? Just so, I guess, you know, we're all looking at the same thing. I mean, these are sort of the sign exceptions should be granted only if, you know, all of these conditions apply. So that's why we're struggling with this, is because obviously, you know, we would really like to say yes, but this is what we have to look at, is if it meets all of these.
So which one doesn't it meet?
That's
I think A is probably the only one. I don't know. Can
it meets the last one, that would be fine.
It doesn't meet the third one?
The third one.
It's not.
Yeah, but it's not, they're not really getting anything by the,
right.
The applicant isn't, so it meets that one.
Yeah, I think the bottom four are
yeah.
Totally
it's
fine.
It's not detrimental to the public welfare.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So which one is it? Is it the second
it's
one?
It's the second one, I think.
Conditions upon which the application for an exception is based would not be applicable generally to other properties within the same zoning.
What is this school zone?
What is the school zone?
It's a building classification is institutional, but it's zoned irresidential. And I will just point out real quick, that one is particularly important, and don't want to be a stickler here, but there was a recent Supreme Court case, Reed versus the Town of Gilbert, this is 2015, and it's pretty landmark because the Supreme Court has never before ruled on signs. They said that sign regulations have to be applicable to businesses, nonprofits, anything. They have to be applied equally. So you can't apply one. You can't extend favors as much as you would like to.
So I can't consider the doctor versus the school.
Right. And the story behind that, just to digress real quick, but the story behind that was there's a pop-up church in the town of Gilbert that was putting signs where they hold services every day. Well, they were allowed to do that, but a business was not. And so the town got sued and made its way over to the Supreme Court. So those are things that, you hate to be a stickler, but that's what we're looking at.
I don't think we have a choice.
Now, you've done these for different school districts, and when we were working on the sign code and we looked at those sign codes, we went and looked at a lot of people's sign codes. So, where have you recently done this for a school? Because it seems like we took most of them into account.
The Howe Elementary School was assigned, was installed last 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a bit larger than what we're proposing here. Now, granted, that was a new sign with a brick base and a large EMC. It looks great. That's Green Bay. That's not here. And again, my approach was really simple, just to update something existing to keep the cost down instead of going through a whole new design process, which we could have done and made it beautiful and $30,000-$40,000 later, my approach was just keep it simple, update the existing. We're a little bit restricted by the EMCs because those are manufactured in 1 foot increments. So we could, in theory, we could shrink the EMC, but that's defeating the whole purpose of updating the cabinet. Thank you.
If I might add, as a teacher in the building, and the way the current educational climate is, and the economics of the educational climate, I would stand here and say that money would be better spent buying supplies and books hands-on for students than bricks for a sign. I mean, the purpose of this sign is to educate parents about activities and events and that it's not to bring in business. Although I know you mentioned the Supreme Court hearing, but Wisconsin's in a different state of mind and in a different economic state, and to take money away from students, I don't think it's the PTO is not going to allow that. I mean, this money was raised by kids selling Hansen's pizzas, and next month we have a fall harvest festival. I mean, this is bits and pieces, to improve the community of Alloway. And
what's not working with the current sign? Why would this be better than what you have currently? I mean, I see an existing sign where somebody's put the letters out there saying now accepting student enrollments. Fourth, fifth grade. I'm just asking how
you're updating, especially with schools. You're updating information almost on a daily basis, weekly for sure. Versus, consider at this point reader boards to be passe.
Yeah.
But when you're going out there physically in January to put up letters, that's last century's technology. Mm.
And I can honestly tell you, we had an incident last week that involved not only the state government but the federal government. There was a citizen that was posing a risk, and the federal government was watching him. And you know, it's a needed tool of communication. You know, we had parents coming and you know, not using that entrance that could be stated, you know, from quickly, rather than waiting for the custodian to, you know, go out and change the sign.
There's a difference in our mission versus the village board. You know, we're charged with what's called findings of fact, which means what, as we've talked about, our ordinance is pretty specific, and we have basis and in law and legal cases that would make us not want to make an exception. The village board has some discretionary, you know, way of just viewing things where we don't. You know, we need to give them our opinion based on findings of fact. And they can take that as a piece of information and make their own judgment. They don't have to do what we say necessarily, but I think we're constrained by what we can do. And that's the message so far that's come out of the conversations here. Maybe others have other comments.
Well, I don't think the village board has a choice either. Looking at Section 3 of the zoning code, the village board, only in accordance with standards set forth in subsection C, can authorize exceptions. So they're going to be faced with the same problem we have unless we change the ordinance.
Yep.
So it's a...
Is it a matter of shrinking the EMC portion to less than 40%? If that was the case of the sign, then... This would be allowable. Is
the
that
type change, right?
It's the type, but is that something that triggers? Okay, then it would have to be on. Okay.
It's something that we could look at the zoning code. I'm giving you my professional opinion because my job is to look out and prevent, I guess, future lawsuits or anything like that. And I'm not saying that if you approve it tonight, I'm not saying that you would have a lawsuit. I'm just saying that when you're making a decision tonight, make sure that you're looking at everything uniformly. And that in the future, if you're getting a similar application but from a different user, you would apply the same decision. If you want to take a look at amending the zoning code, you can also that at a future date.
Trevor, are you, to me, this, I know there's change in the, but it seems that it's very similar to the sign that's there. So what's driving that it's not just a replacement of what's already there? Where did that decision come from?
They're updating the frame, which would be change of size. And then they're also changing from a reader board to an EMC, which is changing type of sign.
And isn't there something about the percentage of what the cost of the original sign is?
Right, yeah.
There's some cost factor, too.
Yeah, if you update the sign over 50%,
you have to replace it.
Clients.
Right. It loses its status.
Yeah. And we are having a constant question about the billboards down on... I don't know if that
would
read into
this. If we
say okay to this, then they may come in and say, well, we can, you know, upgrade that one then too, and then we'll have a bigger problem. So
it's kind of the precedent that we're not able to set.
Yeah.
I know it sounds like a lot, but I've seen this in other communities before, and the way I got around it 10 years ago for a homeowners association that was raising money for the same type of thing was to put out a call to local contractors to see if anybody can give you some in-kind work to maybe create that base.
Be like a sponsorship
situation? Yeah, that worked where I was before. You'd be surprised. I don't know if people would want to help you out it's a PTO organization. That way, you know, everything's met and you don't have to deal with it.
I'm sure there's some contract appearance in that school.
So you're proposing to add a base to what's been designed?
Yeah. That's all I gotta do.
Sure.
Yeah, they'd certainly be more inclined to want to do something in kind there rather than for a,
so, right. So really that's
for a doctor or a lawyer.
The issue of this one, just adding
or a commercial business.
Brick or yeah. Full brick.
Would that solve the issue as if there was a base on it? Or would we still have issues even if they did that?
Well, I think what could happen is if you're modifying the base, I don't know the cost of it, but you're still, if you're changing from the reader board to AEMC, you're still changing the type. So there's a couple options there. You can shrink down the EMC a foot or so to meet that 40%, or you could increase the size because you're allowed to go up to 40 total square feet per side. You could increase the size of the base by a couple square feet, and that would allow you to have that 16 square foot EMC size. Again, I don't want to suggest anything because I don't know the cost and the cost difference of everything, but I think those are the options for this school too.
To leave the square footage as it is on the EMC and then just add a base.
And then to increase a couple square feet on the sign base.
The upper cabinet?
The upper cabinet, yeah. And then that would bring you that.
Sure.
You have 40% there.
No problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
So do we have to make a motion?
I think if the petitioner is agreeable to what discussed, then I don't think you have to make a motion. But if you'd like this to, you know, yeah.
Well, and I can revise the drawing. Is that
sure.
That's up to you. Is that fair enough?
Yeah.
Sure. To get Trevor's approval.
Yeah. I would say that we could table this to another meeting pending a new proposal.
Yeah, if it meets the standards, then it doesn't have to come back to the
package. Right, mm-hmm. Right. You find somebody to do a base for you, and that's not a big base.
No.
You know, so,
yeah.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I hope you get what you need.
Yes.
I hope you really.
No.
This is not a big sign for us at Jones. This is kind of a little.
Do we still need to take an action or do we just
need
to do something?
We're not going
to. I'll make a motion that we table it if necessary to come back to the Plan Commission.
Is there a second?
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Item number 9, action regarding petition from Dan Rorty requesting final plan development district approval for restaurant and microbrewery on parcel AL-44 located at 1649 South Webster Avenue, the former Village Hall property.
Are we close yet? Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Seems like we've seen this.
I know. All of us look older through this process.
You'll be old enough to have a beer with
us. Yeah.
So this is like it's been mentioned. This is something that's been discussed for a little while now. The addition or the change. In this project versus what we saw this time last year is the addition of that commercial space, restaurant and or commercial space. That was a small change in the development agreement. Just waiting for this to load here quick. So this did receive preliminary approval from the Village Board. As you call preliminary approval, it's just does the concept fit within the neighborhood? So that was agreed upon that it does. The final step of the process is looking at the more specifics of the site plan and making sure they have everything that we require, or we typically require. With it being a PDD, there is some flexibility to go outside of what's typically allowed for each site. And there are a few instances in the site, but I think overall there are things that can be worked around. So, again, we're waiting, but I think looking back at some of the points that were brought up at the last meeting for the preliminary approval, there are some questions about snow storage. That has since been addressed. The snow storage will be in the green space behind the building. And then there's also, I think, a lot of comment on parking. They will have 87 stalls, which is slightly up from what we last saw. And then the remaining parcel to the south, there's a big question mark on that last time. We have been working with a user that would be a 9-5 office type user for that site. They don't have any development plans with us yet. And until they have some of those solidified, they ask to be that we wouldn't disclose their name. So, but it is a 9-5 user. They are comfortable going on that site, and they are looking at about a 3,500 square foot office footprint. And in the development agreement, there would be shared parking between the two facilities, shared ingress, egress, and shared dumpster enclosure as well, and stormwater. So all those are kind of reflected in the site plan while we're waiting for it to load. But I guess if you have any questions, feel free to ask them. We do have some representatives here tonight from the development. They can answer them.
And it's staff's recommendation that this is approved.
Yes.
This is
right.
No issues from you guys. All right.
Great.
I'm good.
Me too.
I think we've had a lot of conversations on this.
Yeah, we've talked about this before.
So. I'll make a motion to approve.
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Can we learn abstains?
I'd like to ask a question. What is the name of the restaurant? Why is it being kept secret?
The restaurant or commercial space is not determined at this point who it will be. DeLeer's Construction is constructing it, and the investor is working out his rental agreement, lease agreement. With a couple of individuals, they are trying to have a restaurant go in that location to complement the uses. But the restaurant, I guess I don't even know who it is at this
That's
point.
That's what I mean. Why is it being kept secret? I mean, they say I'm going to be able to restaurant here, then don't tell anybody.
I don't know if it's I think they're working with one or two different individuals, and so they don't have that quite established yet. But in the development agreement that we have with the developer, it does say that it would be a family-oriented business that would be closed after 10 and have no drive-thrus. So those were some of the stipulations.
So there's two different restaurants that are being considered, right?
Yes, I believe. A number, yeah. I think it's true.
Well, when will that be revealed?
I hope soon.
Well, I hope
so. Okay.
And, ma'am, I don't know if you can just say your name for the record. So that the
Laura Kevin, KOEBBEM.
Item number 10, discussion regarding amendment to Article 4 of Chapter 475 of the Village Ordinances, off-street parking.
Good
All right, so again, we look at some of our development plans that we have for the, so we have the corridor study and we have the comprehensive plan. They call for more mixed use, more apartment style. We look at our mix of housing versus what is the county average, and we're both efficient in our multifamily housing. I think countywide, we're about 20, it's about 20% is the average of multifamily. 20 to like 80% multifamily versus single and two family loans. And Village Valley, I believe, is at 9%. So we are slightly deficient. But then you also look at overall trends and lending trends, and a lot of lenders are lending towards multifamily developments, and that seems to be what is being constructed at this point. So this discussion, it's just discussion tonight, is kind of a looking forward to future development, and are we being as welcoming as possible for that future development? And so I sent out a couple emails to some neighboring municipalities, and they sent me back some of what they require. And so I included this sheet in your packets. It includes what the Village Valley requires, which is two spaces per dwelling unit, and one being covered. And then I asked the municipality specific, do you require covered stalls? Obviously, it's a preferred option if you're a tenant. But then also, if there's any recent variances in that code through the PDD, through their PDD process. And so a few of them included what recent PDDs in their communities have allowed, and kind of trends that they're looking at going forward. As you can see, we require probably the most, we require by dwelling unit, and a lot of other municipalities require by bedroom size or by dwelling unit size versus just a blanket by dwelling unit. But I think if we were looking at amending the zoning code, that we would probably want to break it down a little bit more.
Yeah, one of the things that just kind of caught my eye was, so we're an infill community that's not going to have a greenfield apartment complex like maybe West of here or some others. So space is going to be constrained. And I believe through our zoning code changes, we are looking at maybe designating different districts of the community, whether it's the down the corridor that we have and whatever else. So like in Appleton, the Central Business District does not have a requirement. Mm-hmm. You know, what do those districts look like as we go through our zoning process? And, you know, do we segregate between one type versus another, whether it's 1.5 or 0.5 or 1 or whatever else based on district? And the other thing I was talking about earlier was, you know, this is kind of a constraint for our green infrastructure, having this high of a parking requirement, unless we were to allow permeable pavers. But it certainly is one of those unnoticeable barriers that you don't see sticking right out in your face, but is one that is probably something we want to avoid in the future.
Exactly. There's a lot of economics behind that green infrastructure too, because you're not only paying or asking the developer to pay for more pavement, you're asking them to pay for more treatment on a stormwater facility either on site or off site.
Right.
You're also asking them to take up maybe rentable area for parking. I mean,
right.
So
I think the requirement that they be covered is, it kind of takes away that if you have a covered space, it's usually then enclosed, like with a closed garage door, and so that it then it's not communal space anymore. It can only be used by that person in that apartment because they've got a door that shuts over it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that in doing that, then you've got a lot of space that's just sitting there if somebody doesn't have a car or and so that it should be left up to the developer, and that we shouldn't necessarily have to require that there be a covered space for cars.
Yeah, so we let the market decide.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're not being as welcoming as we could with our requirements for all the reasons stated so far.
But then there's winter, and I understand wanting to have covered spaces.
Well, I mean, aesthetically, looking at cars isn't as, you know, it's much more pleasing to look at, you know, closed garage doors as opposed to parking lots full of cars. Like, aesthetically, it's not pleasing to look at parking lots. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
So we should keep them behind the buildings.
Or work green infrastructure until they can look at it.
Yes.
Right, that's right. Yes. There's other ways around that.
Correct.
You know, when I was looking at apartments when I was younger, I was looking at whether they had covered parking or not covered parking, and I made a decision based on that, you know, and that developers know what the market wants.
And I don't know, I mean, same thing when I was looking at apartments. I mean, I always had a lot of people over, or family, I have a large family, like, so where am my family going to park if they come? You know, if there's no place for anyone to park if they come, I mean, that's frustrating from a tenant perspective as well. So it's not that you want to offer, you know, that many extra spaces, but at the same time, offering none is not very helpful either.
Or requiring two spaces for somebody who lives alone and never and only uses one space, if at all. Then that's a space, you know, that somebody else can't, that it should be more common space within the to let anybody use.
So are there particular things in here that if I were to bring this back, I'm also going to be talking with our consultant, because I hate to make a lot of changes to our zoning code, only to have them change again, or knowing that they're going to change. But I think this one in particular is something that a lot of times it's stormwater and parking that are a lot of adding cost to a project. And stormwater, you really can't get around it, nor do you want to. But parking, maybe we can take a look at it.
Are you looking for a specific direction, or what do you want?
Maybe when I'm speaking, If you see anything that you really would like to see, otherwise I'll talk with our consultant and bring something back.
I think one of the things you mentioned is, like, why do we require one stall to be covered? Because we have people here that would have made a choice for themselves. So maybe we want to take that up.
Yeah, and then the two spots per dwelling unit probably doesn't make sense, regardless of bedrooms. Or not thinking about bedrooms, at least that's what I feel.
Yeah,
your studio apartment, you don't need two spaces.
I think, right, some significance on the amount of bedrooms is...
Right.
City
it's
of
an easy fix.
Yeah. City of Appleton is nice. One space for two bedrooms or less. Two spaces for three or more, and then half a space for dwelling unit for guest parking. I mean, it kind of... Something like that. They're all kind of like that. But
I think a lot of the places rely on having street parking, and that was the one thing that when they were looking at those apartments down off of Riverside Drive was that there was no street parking anywhere around there for guests, that it would be a long way to walk. And I don't know if there's some way to codify that in the... You know, if available street parking for guests, I have no idea how you would put that in there. But that would be.
Yeah, we can. I mean, I'll think about it, but then I can also ask for consultant.
And we may be losing street parking if we put more bike lanes and bike accommodations on roads, so then that might make a difference too.
It also may not be a bad idea to think about whether we have some type of equivalent to a central business district where you could waive the requirement in cases where if somebody, you know, if you do have apartment complexes that are on the bus line or right on the trail, you may very well see, especially millennials, looking to get an apartment without needing a parking space. They don't have a car. So there may be some differences depending on where it's located.
Mm-hmm.
and to encourage bicycle parking. We have something to encourage the owners to have bicycle parking and more car parking, or available place to put a bike if you're in a second floor apartment.
Thank you. Item number 11, report discussion regarding annual site meeting tour update.
So, I think you saw in the minutes, or just, I guess, the report, I don't know what you want to call it, but from August 20th, we did go to six different locations. It wasn't enough to have a quorum, but we decided to go anyway. It was a nice night. And we looked at different facilities and saw a lot of the progress being made at the CP Center, the Old River condominiums. I think at that point, everything was just scrubbed. Nothing was in the ground yet. Braeburn condominiums, we looked at the space, or the lack of space for different things. Webster Elementary and Buccaneers and Safe Routes to School Project, I don't know if there's much comment on that, but James and Penny were also there. So sorry. I don't know if you have any comments or...
Well, I think it was good. It's good to do, and we should continue it. And it gives us an opportunity to have a casual conversation, and, you know, and informal, and I learn things that I didn't know before, just because everybody knows something about the site, you know, and we can share our ideas. So I think it's worth continuing, as long as we don't have to do it in the winter.
I do want to add, when you said about the Safe Routes to School and Webster, I do want to add that the City of Green Bay is doing a Safe Routes to School plan for the Green Bay schools and the City of Green Bay. And they have included the two schools in Alloway, and I was asked to help with those. And this week they were at Doty School and Webster School, walking around looking at the patterns, although it was raining on the day we were at Webster School. I did tell the people to get in touch with the village and to get in touch with Sean, because I'm on the Metropolitan Planning Organization subcommittee, and the village has been awarded another TAP grant, and it's going to be able to put sidewalks by Doty School and do improvements at Doty School, so those are going to be included too. So that's good. There's another one coming down, similar to the one for Webster School. It may take a little while to do it because it's federal money, but it's going to be a sidewalk all along East River Drive from Hoffman to the pier on one side, and improvements and sidewalks and stuff in front of Doty School. So they've got 80% funding for that. And I texted Sean the other day, and he said that the village had just gotten the paperwork on it. So it's good.
Awesome.
Item number 12, report discussion regarding village properties and property updates.
I was just going to give you an update on our zoning code. We are working with Duncan and Codometrics. They're currently taking a look at all of Brown County's different GIS information and analyzing that. I have a meeting again with them tomorrow. To discuss some of that information, but the biggest takeaway is we're working through some of the things to get a draft level ordinance, and we'll definitely keep you included and bring any information to you in the future.
And have you mentioned the green infrastructure to them?
I will. There's some good information.
There is some good information, and we really should incorporate that when we have the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have one of the books that they you can pass on to them?
I will send them the link.
Perfect.
Yep. And then, Brad, I don't know if you want to go back to the other we haven't met since the Green Bay Correctional Institution information.
The economic impact study was completed by St. Norbert and was presented to the village board. We got some nice press on that again. It was showing that, I couldn't remember the numbers, I believe it was $138 million annually in economic impact and upwards of 52, depending on what is put into this facility, $100 million, $80 million in property value. So the study was well done, and we can send it out to you because it's probably worth reading through versus me trying to explain it because I'm not an economist like Dr. Schaefer. He did a great job presenting it, and it was very useful. There's a few highlights that I think should be taken from it. They did look at the number of jobs that potentially could be created, and it's in the 1,000 to 1,400, depending on how you look at it, the indirect and direct sewer jobs and those that are on site. Are those all new jobs? Probably not, because they might be just a business relocating from one spot to another. But very, very informational. We'll get that out to you. While I've got the mic, I'm going to bring up a couple other items that, as far as projects that are going on. The duplex that the Plan Commission approved on East River Drive, that's been all staked out, so it looks like they're getting close to breaking ground on that. It'll be nice. And
Which one is that?
It's right by Ziggy's.
Yeah, by Ziggy's, right?
Yeah.
The Sisters.
Yeah.
Okay. It's been a while, so I was thinking, is that still the same?
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad that's moving forward.
What they're waiting on is both of them had to sell their own individual properties and get everything on that site. So.
So, yeah, looking forward to that getting started. And they do have one of the homes or twin doors being built on the condo project on Riverside Drive. And I believe, is it three of them that they have sold or four of them?
Three or four
that they have sold. So keep our fingers crossed that things keep coming.
Brad, this is just a comment. But wouldn't the prison site be a great place to start with green infrastructure?
Absolutely. Actually, if you look at the design that David Robillard put together, it does incorporate some of that. Yeah.
Another green space built in there.
Mm-hmm. Brad, the presentation is available online at the St. Norbert College site. It's a half hour. Really good. So if you don't want to read the whole book,
thanks, Joe.
Any updates on the pump house?
Well, if you would like to open it up, maybe Mr. O'Rourke can answer some of those questions. We have met with Thomas and what's the brother?
John.
They were in town about a week or two ago, and they were excited about the project. I think it's going to be, if it is anything like what they built in Chicago, it's going to be really nice.
So it's sold then?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It has been sold. And the other project that we should bring up is the property on Riverside Drive that we built on a country.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, we're supposed to close this Friday, but the survey and easements are still not completed, more so the easements, releasing the easements that are all over on that property. Once that's all completed, then we can close on the property, and Ms. Clausen can get started.
So what is the business at the pump house? What type of business is that?
It's an art studio, and tool library.
Okay.
Really, if we'd like to open it up, Jim can tell us more because his brother is the one that purchased it.
Ah.
Would we like to open it up?
I'd be interested to hear where we're going with that.
Okay.
So I make a motion to open.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Jim O'Rourke, 2339 Oakwood. First of all, it's a difficult building because of the reservoirs and the foot-and-a-half thick concrete, and you're below grade on some of the stuff. So the original plan was designed to use about 1,200 square feet that's available to use right away. So they'll be making that. The property's currently condemned. They'll be repairing the roof, getting that taken care of immediately. And we've had contractors in evaluating where we can cut holes in the reservoir to get access in there and possibly create a living space. It's supposed to be live workspace for artists. And depending upon what we can do structurally with the property, maybe putting a second story on the back over the reservoir, is leaving the front facade the way it looks right now, and making repairs and possibly putting on an art studio and an art gallery in the round reservoir. And then it all depends upon what you can do structurally with the building. There's an awful lot of concrete inside to work around. They've already repainted the front, got all the chipping paint off, and they have contractors lined up to start doing the work as soon as possible.
Cool.
Thank you, Jim.
Mm.
Okay. Motion to return to regular? Motion?
So moved.
Second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. And item number 13, report discussion regarding standing committees.
I'll mention the parks, and if Brad wants to mention something on Martha for Public Works. So parks, if you've been by Optimus, you'll see that they're doing a lot of work on their parking lot and parking facilities. They dug quite a bit out of the existing parking lot, what was existing, and added quite a bit of gravel and base to that because of the soil conditions. And then, so that's the existing area, and then on the northern side, along Paul, they'll also be adding in some additional parking there. They're in the process of digging that out at the moment. The parks, because the committee hasn't met, or commission hasn't met since, but the parks committee also had the Puget First inaugural Puget and Pints event that went very well. There's over 300 people there in attendance, and each partnering organization, which shares two organizations that partnered with the village, received $1,700 in profit benefit organizations. So that was good. And then the final one that the parks director gave me is the Buccaneers building that was at the Plan Commission a while back that's now completed and operational.
Public Works has been working with a developer, Bill Johnson and Dean Johnson. Both Elway residents have purchased the vacant three lots, right across from St. Matthew's on Webster and Martha Court, or Martha Street would dead end to that development or into that property. So what's we're working on right now is finalizing the developer's agreement for the extension of the road. The road is just going to still dead end, but it will enter into the property, extending water, sewer, and storm sewer into the property. So that they've sold one lot already, and then they plan on developing the other two lots with the homes roughly in the $300,000 range. Looking forward to that. It's a piece of property that's been discussed many times, many different options or proposals that have come forward, and the village is participating in the bringing the utilities into the site, so like a 50%, roughly 50% of the cost.
It's interesting because the only parcels left in Alloway you have to be very creative to use, and we've seen some very creative uses lately. It's some struggles. You guys have gone through a lot to get where, but it's working. Seems to be anyway.
All right, item number 14, next meeting and future agenda items.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I'm like,
okay. Yeah, guess we'll have one.
Yeah, sure. I don't know if we need to, if there are any items that from here are coming back.
I'll probably have the parking one come back.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone have anything else? No? All right. Item number 15.
So is it on the 26th?
22nd.
Okay.
I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Nobody ever
Man, I feel bad about
that. Yeah, but they'll be able to find somebody to build a base.
Yeah.
I've had this for a long time.
Oh, okay.